Director and animator Henry Selick is best known for films like The Nightmare Before Christmas and Coraline. He's now teamed up with co-writer Jordan Peele for a new stop-motion animated movie for Netflix called Wendell and Wild. Peele also stars in the film alongside Keegan-Michael Key as a pair of demon brothers who cross over to the land of the living with the help of a rebellious teen with a tragic past. I'm Glenn Weldon, and today we're talking about Wendell and Wild on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining me today is iHeartRadio producer and host Joelle Monique. Hey, Joelle.
Hi, Glenn.
Also with us is film critic and writer Carlos Aguilar. Hey, Carlos.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. And rounding out our panel is writer Kiana Fitzgerald. Welcome back, Kiana.
Hey, thank you so much.
Of course. So in Wendell and Wild, Lyric Ross voices the sullen teenager Cat. Her parents died in a car accident years before, and she is now relocated to the Rust Bank Catholic School for Girls. Rust Bank is her hometown, and it's fallen on hard times since the brewery originally owned by her parents burned down, killing much of the population. The evil, rich real estate developers Irmgard and Lane Claxon, voiced by Maxine Peake and Dave Harewood, probably had something to do with that, and now they're getting help from Cat's school's smarmy headmaster, Father Bests, voiced by the great James Hong. But Cat is going to get some help, too, from her mysterious teacher, Sister Helly, voiced by Angela Bassett. She'll also eventually get help from demon brothers Wendell and Wild, who long to escape the underworld and create something special. They are voiced by Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele. But if they are to make it to the land of the living, they'll need Cat and some necromantic hair cream. It's a long story. But Cat has a request for them, one that will bring them in conflict with their demon father, Buffalo Belzer, who is voiced unmistakably by Ving Rhames. The last film that director, producer, and co-writer Henry Selick made was Coraline back in 2009. Before that, he made Monkey Bone, The Nightmare Before Christmas, and James and the Giant Peach. Here, he's teamed up with Jordan Peele, whom we all know from Nope, Us, Get Out, and of course, Key and Peele. He's a producer, and he co-wrote the screenplay. Wendell and Wild is streaming on Netflix. Oh, there's so much to this movie. Joelle, can I start with you?
Okay. What I liked about this movie, alternative black girl is angry and it's totally okay. That really rocked with me. I really enjoyed watching her journey. I thought the music was amazing. I think perhaps another script pass and a little tighter editing would have helped a lot. This movie feels so long. I was like, are we still in this? But I really enjoyed the visuals and some of the performances were great. Angela Bassett specifically is like a demon hunting nun is really soul satisfying. So there's a lot to enjoy. I'll probably revisit later when life is less hectic and maybe I hope I'll enjoy it a little bit more, but it was felt a little long of a tooth to me.
Okay. What about you, Carlos?
Yeah. I mean, I agree with the fact that it does feel a bit overstuffed in terms of like some the many layers of themes that it's trying to cover. But, you know, despite that, I am a big fan just because I'm a big fan of Henry Selick and I enjoy him now with his partnership with Jordan Peele. They both seem to really have a great talent for blending horror and comedy or sort of the otherworldly and comedy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, stop motion is a medium that just fascinates me in terms of how it's conceived and the painstaking nature of it all, you know, making these figures move one frame at a time. And so the sort of weird, very strange kind of characters and world that he builds here, I think it's just fantastic. I also particularly love a small detail that I'm sure, you know, a lot of people will notice is that Selick decided to keep the seams on the faces of the characters for this, which is something that in stop motion animation currently, you know, the Leica films and others, they sort of remove digitally. And so he wanted to step back and sort of leave the sort of mark of the artist so people know that this is handcrafted, handmade. And so, you know, just a small thing that really sort of reminds you of what goes behind the scenes to make this happen.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right, Kiana, break. And it's not really a tie. We're all kind of coming down, I think, in the same place. Where'd you come down?
Yeah, I'd have to say I'm pretty similar in terms of how I received this movie. I do want to say that I appreciate that it's a story that anybody can relate to. It's not something that is specifically about Black trauma or anything of that nature. It's just like a story about trauma in general that isn't specific to the Black experience. Mm-hmm. There were elements here that, I don't know, they kind of got to me in terms of understanding that bad things happen to people close to me. I have these bad memories and I don't know how to reconcile with them. I've had this tragedy in the past and it's still bothering me years and years later. These are all things that anybody can understand. Mm-hmm. And I think as, you know, a movie that could kind of be placed in this bigger picture of, you know, Henry Selick's legacy, I think that it may not be as canonical as the others that he's done, but I do think that it matters, and I really appreciate the effort that was put into it.
Yeah, let's talk about the effort that was put into it just technically. I mean, as Carlos said, what an achievement, because stop motion is a labor of love, but there's a hell of a lot of labor in that love. It's so meticulous and time-consuming and precise, and handmade is the word that you use, Carlos, and it has a look and a feel that CGI can approach but never get to. So you spend the first few minutes of this movie just goggling at the artistry, the craft, right? The fact that every frame just feels painstakingly wrought, created. And then 5 minutes in, you forget all about it, and you're just in the world. And it's like, it's exactly what the filmmakers are going for, right? They want you to just get lost in the world. I think you have to be something of a masochist to get involved in stop motion animation. This movie didn't land on me right the first time. Can we just say to parents, to kids, to anybody, this movie goes hard. You were thinking Henry Selick, you're thinking dark gothic whimsy, you're thinking Coraline, you're thinking Nightmare. And Nightmare, of course, is, as we mentioned, a Henry Selick film. It is not a Tim Burton film. Tim Burton wrote the story for that and produced it, but Nightmare is a Henry Selick film. So don't get that twisted. And this is, you know, you're expecting dark and creepy and funny light horror for the tweens and the teens at heart. A visit to Hot Topic, I would say. Nope. You get parent death. You get guilt. We watch some souls getting tortured. There is murder. There is real estate development, perhaps the most evil thing of all. And we meet a character who is punk, who treats everyone like crap. And that's who she is. And that's, as you said, Joelle, that is just part of the deal. We do get, as you all mentioned, this pileup of lore and subplots. And this movie is not alone in that. Kids' movies are doing this a lot more nowadays. I have tilted at this windmill before, but there's just a lot of stuff in here that just saps the narrative momentum. We get Hell Maidens, we get Hair Cream, we get Demon Hunting, we get Town Bylaws, we get an artistic kid, and we get a kid with ties to the villains. Now, I love who those villains are. I think this movie really picks the right targets in a lot of rich institutions. You got private prisons, you got exploitative landowners, you got the Catholic Church doesn't come out looking too rosy here. I love the needle drops, as you mentioned, Joelle, the Fishbone, Living Color, the Brat, TV on the Radio. I love the trans kid. I love making a movie where your hero is a kid of color. I didn't like her, but I don't think she wanted me to. So, like, mission accomplished there.
Yeah.
I don't think the movie particularly wanted me to. So this isn't goth whimsy. This is punk.
Yeah.
Until we get to the lesson, the importance of family, but you can't get around that. It's a kid's movie.
I liked her a lot, but I think because, but because you don't get a lot of non-likable black girls.
Cool.
You know what I mean? Like a lot of, like, to me, I think if I were much younger, like 13, I think I would have been like, this is my new identity because she gets to be like, again, just justifiably angry and upset. She experiences so much trauma and all of her angst is about, please don't get close to me. Mm-hmm. She doesn't view herself as heroic, which I think she really wished she had been when her parents passed. You know, the one person who's really nice to her, she's constantly like, we are not friends. Do not talk to me. People around me get hurt.
I don't do friends, Raul. Bad things happen to people I'm close to.
Like what?
They die.
To see a child character who's built up so many walls around herself, I mean, that's very identifiable. And I think, you know, a lot of teens aren't very nice.
No,
I like that we get to see them sort of in that element and that nobody chastises her for it. There's nobody ever comes in and is like, you need to be nicer or like share or anything like that. She's always encouraged to sort of get grounded within herself, which I think is maybe the best lesson. And there's also like a whole prison industrial complex slide throughout this, and she's been to jail as a young child. A lot of Black youth have been detained in prison systems, and so again, to sort of have a space where they can still, as children, engage with that narrative, I value.
Yeah, I was going to add to your point of the sort of themes that are a little darker than what people might expect. You know, this movie is a PG-13 movie, which is so rare for an animated film to sort of get that label and to sort of embrace it, you know?
It's true.
You know, Henry Selick has said that, you know, they didn't deliberately sort of set out to get that rating, but once they got it, you know, they were okay with it because it allows for a little more freedom in terms of, you know, how dark you can make it, how much you can push. You get even a couple curse words that you could throw in there, you know, and still get a PG-13, which, you know, in the age of streaming those sort of barriers that, you know, that you might have encountered, you know, 20 years ago going to the theater and not being able to buy a ticket for an R-rated movie or even a PG-13 movie don't really apply. Mm-hmm. It's sort of left to the parents and whoever's watching. But I do appreciate that, you know, an animated film is given sort of that range to dig deeper and to sort of like talk about these harsher things and emotions in a way that doesn't feel preachy or sort of like message driven, but sort of just embraced it within the story. And I feel like a lot of those layers did come from Jordan Peele's, you know, ability to handle those themes in a way that feels authentic and not sort of as someone, you know, an outsider sort of trying to walk in and pretend to know what he's talking about. So I feel like that partnership between, you know, Selleck and him and sort of their share ability to let, you know, each one of them do what they do best and sort of like collaborate, I think that really made a difference in terms of how some of the topics are handled here.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with both of you. And I just want to also add that I'm so glad that this character, Kat, was allowed to just figure herself out without rush, without additional pain. She has a lot of caring people around her, whether she wants it or not. And I think that that really will resonate with folks who have either past or present or maybe even a future of trying to figure out, like, why am I going through this traumatic experience and how do I relate to the people around me as I'm navigating it? Especially for young Black girls who aren't really given the grace and space to do that all the time. Either you're angry or you're in the way or, you know, anything that isn't considered positive. So for her to be given like love and adoration and support, even though she wasn't quite ready for it at all times, really spoke volumes to me.
Yeah, that's a key part of the film, and I think it's actually a Peele part of the film, because Jordan Peele came in, and I think Henry Selick, in some of our production notes, noted that originally this was a Sister Helly story. Mm-hmm. Now, I'd be down for that. Angela Bassett fighting demons, yeah. But it's so important, and Jordan Peele keyed into it, to have a young Black kid character as the center of your movie. Mm-hmm. And it gives it this resonance. I mean, I think the Angela Bassett demon hunting movie would be awesome, but it wouldn't vibrate on this frequency, which I think is a very important one. That said, there's a review that calls the world of this particular film, you know, you'll want to explore it and savor and live in it. That's nuts. This is not like Halloween Town from Nightmare would be fun to live in. The Other Mother's House is creepy and scary fun. This is just the real world stylized into a kind of brutalist, ugly, it's expressionist, I suppose, but the world of this film is kind of intentionally beautifully ugly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting to place a movie in what feels like modern times, right? She has her dad's like old giant stereo, which sort of to me plays like, you know, her closer to our time, to be set in a company town, which is not something we see a lot anymore. And I think it is missing a layer of character of setting, right? Like it's not that strong decisions weren't made, but if you had placed this in another time period, I think that level of whimsy gets amped. And to me, that's what I really like about a Selleck project is like, it's whimsical in parts and it kind of carries you and you are fascinated and you do want to lurk in these spaces a little longer. We kind of get there in these very quiet dream sequences or maybe memory palace spaces that are all green where she's revisiting these moments of her life or where she's kind of like looking back and looking over things. I think that works really well there. I'm like trying to put my finger on like what I'm not enjoying because I love the entire creative team and I really like the idea behind the story, but for whatever reason, and I think it is that layer of whimsy, it doesn't quite connect as much as like a Coraline or a Nightmare Before Christmas for me.
I agree that it doesn't feel sort of whimsical. I think it works for this. I really did like the Selleck hire this Argentine designer, Pablo Lovato, who makes sort of these caricatures of famous people that look like Picasso paintings. And so I feel like you can see that in how he designed the characters. You know, he wanted to make caricatures of Jordan Peele and Key that look like them, but that didn't sort of feel like the ones that you get at the pier or at, you know, that someone makes of you for like $20 somewhere. And so I feel like there were some interesting decisions there in the character design. And also you could see some of, you know, Selleck's fascinations or interests throughout. Like, for example, the Buffalo Devil character reminds me so much of Oogie Boogie from Nightmare Before Christmas. You know, there's some of, they exist in the same sort of like wavelength. He's talked about how amusement parks have always been sort of like, you know, one of his fascinations. I think there's one in like Monkey Bone. And so there are things that make it feel, you know, part of the legacy of Henry Selick, but at the same time, it is less whimsical. It is less sort of like colorful. Like it is a world that feels sort of like drab and not a place where you want to spend a lot of time. Maybe their depiction of hell is a little, it's fun, but you know, you also see like torture souls, you know, in the opening mm-hmm. sequence. So
yeah,
I mean, I think even if I don't find that, you know, visually beautiful, I think it is compelling and it does work with the story that they're trying to tell.
I feel like the lack of whimsy and prettiness and fun nature kind of reflects where we're at right now.
Right.
nothing is pretty. Nothing is wrapped up in a pretty little bow, tightly assessed. Like, that's just not life. So I feel like that kind of might be a reflection of what's going on there. But I really appreciate the world that was set up. And, you know, it's dark, it's creepy. I grew up in a factory town, so there are a lot of parallels that I saw mm-hmm. between this movie and the things that I experienced growing up. So yeah, there are a lot of connections here that I made. And, you know, as much as I appreciate the darkness and the reality of it, I feel like if I was younger, I'd be like, oh, I wish there was more color, or I wish there was X, Y, or Z. But, you know, the story itself, I think, is the most potent part of this. And I think that that's what's going to keep people watching.
Absolutely.
Before we started rolling, you mentioned your sister had like a really deep connection to the story. Yeah. Can you talk about like what her connection was?
Absolutely. So our mother, our single mother, passed away in 2009. And my sister always felt a level of guilt about that. And it took her a long time to let that go. And so at the end of the movie, you know, she kind of shed some tears and was like, wow, like I understand what this young cat character is going through, because, you know, I was really young when our mom passed and I never really was able to establish myself through those feelings right away. Mm-hmm. And to see how far she's come was really beautiful. And to see herself in this movie was really beautiful. And it made me think about this movie in a different lens, because it may not be for me, may not be for you, but it could be for someone else.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would say it's a much more adult or a much deeper exploration of sort mm-hmm. of child trauma. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's heavy.
Yeah, it's heavy.
I wanted to say that I'm very happy that Henry Selick is back. But, you know, to think about the fact that such a accomplished and highly regarded artist had to wait more than a decade to make a new project, and that it really, as he has said multiple times, it really did happen because of Jordan Peele and, you know, his interest and sort of like the success that he found after Get Out, that gave him sort of like the leverage to be able to position this film, you know, at Netflix and sort of like make it happen. And so, you know, I think that's incredible that Jordan Peele, you know, uses sort of his you know, his success to sort of help artists that he admires and whatnot. But, you know, I wish that it wouldn't be so difficult for someone like Selick to continue make movies, because, you know, it's I don't want to say he lost a decade, but I feel like there were other projects he could have made before this. It speaks about where the industry is at in terms of like what's financed, what's seen as profitable or not, even in the streaming era where we might think that's the place for more challenging work to exist. I still think that it's not really the case, particularly in the animation world, that it's so driven by, you know, movies that have to make millions and millions of dollars at the box office to be considered a success.
Agreed.
Seeing Jordan Peele and Keegan-Michael Key back together, even in this format.
Yeah.
Carlos had mentioned earlier the characterization of these guys in here. And if you are familiar with the Key and Peele sketches, it definitely feels like maybe some of those characters got pulled up. There's one they mm-hmm. do with like a very funky beard that Wilde definitely sports throughout the film. Mm-hmm. It was delightful. I sort of missed a little bit the improvisation they're able to do, which is obviously not really lends itself to this medium, but mm-hmm. it's still delightful and a lot of fun. And if you miss them, you know, you can get a dose of it here.
Yeah. And it's funny, you know, the second time through, I was much more on this film's wavelength. I think this film has a wavelength that it wants you to come to, right? Mm. It's you doing the work, and that's fine, and that's good, and that actually makes it somehow more satisfying. Mm-hmm. Tell us what you think about Wendell and Wilde. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. Up next, what's making us happy this week?
This message comes from NPR sponsor Smartwool. How important is it to you that companies are putting the planet first? Smartwool is committed to sustainability, using natural, responsibly sourced merino wool in their gear and recycled materials in their packaging. every single item Smartwool makes is backed by their Go Far, Feel Good guarantee, ensuring you're 100% satisfied with every Smartwool purchase. Enjoy 15% off your first order of base layers, socks, and accessories at smartwool.com.
Now it is time for our favorite segment of This Week and Every Week. What is making us happy this week? Joelle, what is making you happy this week?
Well, Glenn, I don't have to tell you that I'm a Star Wars stan. We have had many a conversation.
Given.
Andor is out right now, and not everyone is watching it, and it's making me a little bit crazy. It is absolutely the thing Star Wars fans have been pleading for a very long time. It's what I had expected to get out of the prequel movies. It's what I finally experienced in Rogue One, what I think is maybe one of the best Star Wars movies of all time. You get Stellan Skarsgård in a performance that if he doesn't get at least a nomination for an Emmy, I will riot and personally burn Hollywood to the ground. I tweeted the other day that the show is able to make politics just intriguing and engaging in a way that George Lucas has always wanted for the series, but never quite reached. I mean, we're just walking people like walk around a room plotting about a rebellion and you are on the edge of your seat, like, please don't get caught. You're too close to people. You have to, like, that kind of heart pounding action in a dialogue scene, challenging to write. It's sensational. And I just, at every turn, I'm just making sure I tell people, like, please watch Andor. Please make sure we get more shows like this. Please let people know that Diego Luna is, like, just running circles around this set, being just amazing. I'm obsessed. I'm obsessed with Andor, and everyone needs to be watching it.
That is Andor on Disney Plus, which we will be talking about on this show, and I don't want to spoil my opinion, but I will just say, Joelle, you are so not wrong. You are very, very much not wrong. Carlos, what is making you happy this week?
There's a movie that I love called After Sun that opened last week, and it did very well at the box office. It's a tiny movie about a father and a daughter from Scottish director Charlotte Wells, stars Paul Mescal, and it's a beautiful story set in the 90s, and it's small, and it's just unique in the way it tells, you know, a story about memory. And just to see that people really, you know, showed out for it, and, you know, there were sold out screenings in LA and New York the last weekend, you know, for such a sort of tiny, not loud movie, in the sense that, you know, the publicity is just mostly, you know, like critics reviews and sort of people hyping it up on Twitter.
Yeah.
That gives me a little hope that there's still audiences out there for that. I mean, it's an A24 movie, which I think that really helps now that there's sort of like a, you know, a whole generation of movie watchers that, you know, have built their identity around A24. And that's good and bad. But in this case, I'll take it as a win that they show out for this movie, After Sun.
That's After Sun, which is in theaters right now. I've been hearing lots of good things. Kiana, what is making you happy this week?
What's making me happy this week is not as recent. It is the 2002 film Scooby-Doo.
Okay. All right.
I have been in love with this movie for the past 2 decades, and it's just the silliest, most ridiculous film that I've ever encountered. It's just the gift that keeps on giving. I watch it every year around this time, and it just always brings me so much joy. And I even had a birthday cake based around this movie some years back. So it's just a wonderful experience. If you haven't seen it, please see it. And of course, the soundtrack is also very fun.
Yep.
I love Land of a Million Drums by Outkast.
Sure.
You know, it's just something that I think would bring a lot of levity to people who are, you know, in a dark time, or even just people who want to laugh. So yeah, Scooby-Doo 2002, that's what's making me happy this week.
All right. You know, in the annals of film history, if you come up with a list of films where actors are perfectly matched to their roles, that film, man, beat for beat, everybody in it. Just great. All right. What's making me happy this week? I mean, we lost Leslie Jordan this week. That's certainly not what's making me happy. But the affection for him that has been welling up recently in reaction to that news, he came, of course, to widespread awareness as Beverly Leslie on Will and Grace, but he was plugging away for years before that, and he's been plugging away since. He got this wildly incongruous late-in-life social media following that was driven entirely by his authentic self. No handlers, no consultants. Our colleague, Ayana Archie, has put a bunch of them together on NPR.org. You can check that out. But if you want to check out my favorite Leslie Jordan performance, you can find it streaming on Peacock. It is in Southern Baptist Sissies, which is a play written and directed by Del Shores that was filmed in 2013. And it's about growing up gay in the evangelical church. And of course, the play goes to a lot of places you think it's gonna. preaching to the choir, I guess, as it were. But it's got some performances, great performances that really sell it. Two of them belong to Dale Dickey and Leslie Jordan. They play a pair of barflies who are kind of off on their own corner of the stage as a kind of Greek chorus. He is just effortlessly hilarious. And at one point, I think he breaks up his scene partners and you can just feel him sitting in it, just basking in that.
Well, as for me, I'm just a social drinker. You have a drink, so shall I.
He also gets to be profoundly moving in this play as well. But mostly he is just authentic, you know, natural, being himself in a way that a lot of gay men never achieve. He was a mensch, he's going to be missed. But if you've got this performance in Southern Baptist Sissies on Peacock to remember him by, and that is what is making me happy this week. And if you want links for what we recommended, plus some more recommendations, sign up for our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. That brings us to the end of our show. Carlos Aguilar, Joelle Monique, Kiana Fitzgerald, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Glenn.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This episode was produced by Chloe Weiner and edited by Ramel Wood and Jessica Reedy. And Hello Come In provides our theme music, which you are torturing a soul to right now. Thanks to listening for Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Glenn Weldon, and we'll see you all next week.